Hello and welcome to my week 10 postpartum update, Anna here. Before I start, I want to acknowledge that I am here on the unceded lands of the Awabakal people, Awabakal country around Lake Macquarie, and pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge the survival of Aboriginal and First Nations peoples and their culture in the face of some very, very violent history. And I have been educating myself over the last number of years and always step it up again around this time of January 26. So if you would like to do the same, you can take a look at various websites in relation to your local area. You can take a listen to some different podcasts, Frontier War Stories being one of them. And you can also have a look at the University of Newcastle's, I think it's called Frontier or Colonial Massacre Map Tool, which brings up a map of Australia, and you can see what atrocities of six or more victims have happened in your local area, and you'll be pretty horrified to see just how many events of that nature have been documented all around the country, knowing that there are probably many more that have not been. So yeah, that's what I want to start with, and let's go on to this postpartum update. The last update that I did was at 7.5 weeks, and we're now at 10 weeks. So being that bit further along from the birth, there's not much to say in terms of my physical recovery during that time. I've been trying to do my pelvic floor exercises when I remember. That is hit and miss. I've been a bit more consistent the last few days, and I tend to be more and more consistent knowing that my appointment is coming up soon with the physio. So hopefully I've got a better system in place now to remember to do it. I have not done heaps of walking or other exercises. It's been a busy time. It's been hard to get get out of the house. It's just been hard to get away from my three-year-old, basically. She told me this morning, I'm a big fan of Mama right now. And I was like, oh yeah, I know. Yeah, she is a firecracker. And I have been putting a lot of effort into connection and attachment play and setting loving limits and listening to her feelings when those limits are set. So that might be things like just that she's had enough screen time and I tell her that it's time to turn it off and she wants to keep watching. And yeah, it's the end of that. And she has a big bubbling explosion of feelings, and that would have happened whether I'd turned the screen off half an hour before or 3 hours later, because the screen is a suppression tool for her. But I also am not going to take it away completely because I value a bit of time with her distracted from me. Yeah, there were times where I'd kind of put 2 full hours into really playing hard with her, child-led play, trying not to be interrupted by other things, cooking, whatever. And I did have the baby with me for some of that time. And towards the end of that 2 hours, I fed the baby on the lounge, and then I knelt down on the mat in front of where we were, and I kept talking with my big girl and joking and laughing with her. And as I go to change this nappy, she's snatching my hands away so that I couldn't attend to baby. And I said, oh, it looks like you still want to be cuddly with me. Here you go. Here's my leg. You can cuddle my leg. And so she started like grabbing and wrestling my leg and writhing all over it, and then started licking and biting my toes. It's just like, I can't handle this. And my partner was around somewhere else in the house. I called him over and was like, I can't deal. You'll have to take her away. And that's pretty much an example of a point that we've got to just about every single day. And by midday yesterday, I was like, holy moly, we just need to get out of this house. I cannot be within these four walls or this. It was raining, so we couldn't go out in the yard much. I'm sure we could have if I did raincoat and umbrella and whatever. Very hard when you're also holding a tiny baby. I'd love to spend lots of time outside, but between heat and rain, they're not ideal situations for a tiny baby. So, yeah, I just was like, we have to get out. We have to leave. We did. So I think a lot of mothers will find this situation where it's a bit of a push-pull between feeling like you gave everything to your first baby, and then when the second baby is here, feeling like you still have to give enough to your older child or children, but also feeling that you're not giving the baby as much as you did the first one. So either way, it's kind of feels a bit unfair that someone is missing out. And I have done a lot of work on reframing that to see where each child is then building relationships with other people that's not with me. I can't remember if I've talked about this before. Sorry if I have. So at times where I wouldn't have been happy to hand my older child over to someone else, my baby now is getting a chance to form attachment relationships with other people earlier than she did. And my older child is learning to find comfort in other people more readily than she would otherwise if it was just me around. And we've built those relationships up over time, but now it's just a case that it has to happen rather than it being an optional thing, because there's only so many hands and sets of eyes that I have, and also seeing the relationship that they are starting to develop with each other. So in the last week particularly, my big girl's not interested in helping with changing the baby or bathing particularly. Oh, she kind of pours a little cup of water over her legs and stuff sometimes, but she's not a really she doesn't try and mimic parenting tasks. So instead, she'll sometimes play around us while we're doing things. Sometimes she'll get every nappy out of the packet and throw them all around the room, singing Let It Go from Frozen and throwing them around and telling me they're snowflakes. And I'm just like, it will end, it will end, it will end. And trying to breathe or join in with the play somehow or sing the song or whatever. And eventually, she usually packs them all up again because we've practiced it many times. But yeah, this week she's just started being a bit more talkative with each other. They're kind of doing some call response cooing, and my big one's bringing her toys over and kind of making them dance a little bit to a song, and the baby's smiling and pretty close to laughing at that. So yeah, there are nice bits too. It has been a fair bit more difficult emotionally than physically lately. I'm also coming to the realization, and have been for some weeks, that I really didn't have a grasp on just how anxious I was first time around. And thinking that, yeah, it was at a much higher level earlier than I recognized, and how much the support I had in place for my first postpartum really really was the only thing that stopped me from breaking down, basically. And then that is side by side with feeling how the support that I have this time is the only thing keeping me from breaking down, even though I'm considerably less worried and anxious this time around. So, yeah, hitting my limits with my older child in terms of my patience quite quickly. The games that she wants to play are very, very prescriptive. Yeah, and it's just, yeah, it's hard and it's repetitive, and there's only so long I can feign interest in pretending that I've never seen something before and giving the exact scripted reaction that she wants. And while also kind of, I don't know, the word reparenting is coming up. I think that's because I'm reading Lael Stone and Marion Rose's book, Raising Resilient and Compassionate Children, which pretty much encapsulates perfectly the style of parenting and parenting philosophy that I'm trying to employ with my children. It's just been released in, I think, December or November. It's a really lovely book, and the audio version's coming out in February. So definitely get your ears or eyes around that book. But yeah, just trying to do what I can, and it really takes all of me. And that alongside, well, it takes all of me in the moment, and then, but also recognizing that I'm trying to be kind and compassionate to myself, also stay engaged in some of the things that I enjoy, because I believe that our children, particularly our daughters, need to see us doing things that we enjoy for ourselves. And, you know, the words like fill us up and light our, fill our cups and light us up and all that sort of stuff. So she needs to see me having fun in what I enjoy, as well as just exactly what she wants me to do. And yeah, I've been having this wrestle with myself of, I feel so well, I feel so good this time. And then I have this voice in my head going, yeah, but it's just because you've got your partner home all the time. You know, it's a farce or a fraud, or you're faking it. If he wasn't here, you'd be a mess. So you're not really well at all. It's all an illusion, which is really interesting that that's coming up. It shows how ingrained that thought process is, because I spend a lot of my time talking with other people and writing about how postpartum support is mental health care and suicide prevention. And we know that support really reduces the rates of postnatal depression and postnatal anxiety. And of course that is the case. And yet I still have this niggle of, yeah, but you being well isn't real. Because what is, you know, common and therefore seen as normal in our culture, that I should be alone with my children and I should also be coping while alone with my children, that voice is still there. And yeah, that's taken me really by surprise how much that's still nagging at me often. The other thing that's really helping me out this time that I didn't have first time around is consolidated blocks of sleep. And I put that down to, you know, A, temperament of this baby compared to the first, and being a generally higher sleep needs compared to a lower sleep needs child. Because there's no one amount that's perfect for every age. You know, every age group, there will be a range of needs for sleep, same as adults. So there's that, but also co-sleeping from the start has made a huge difference, and getting on top of our feeding challenges early. So feeding is still a thing that we are sorting out together. I've been reclined feeding her pretty much the whole time, but it's still not been enough to mitigate my overactive letdown. And that basically means that on the right side, there's kind of, once she stimulates a letdown response, if we're either sitting up or reclined feeding, if I detach her mouth, then there are three very fast jet streams coming out of the breast, and they will keep going out for up to a minute, and I let them spray into a towel and then let her attach back on. So that's what I've been doing for quite some time, but I've come to the conclusion that it's really, that it's not enough. I would also kind of feed her two, like, so she would usually feed twice per awake period during the day and then nap, and then I would feed her on the other side next time she was awake. So I'd do two feeds that side instead. But yeah, it's just not cutting it. Her poos are still very green and frothy and mucousy, and she's been swallowing more air and having more burps. And I sort of thought that it would remedy itself over time as she got bigger and her digestive system got more mature and whatever, and it's actually been getting worse the last couple of weeks. Probably also because we've been out a bit and I haven't been able to recline as much during the day. She's also been catnapping in the day rather than having longer sleeps, which means that some of those feeds are getting closer together than they would be, because she keeps falling asleep in the car and then we arrive somewhere and the engine turns off and she wakes up. Or like this morning when she'd gone back to sleep and my big girl came into bed with us and decided that she would warm her hands up by holding the baby's feet with her freezing cold hands and woke her up straight away. And all of those sorts of things. So I have changed just in the last 2 or 3 days to feeding lying completely flat on my back and also block feeding. So what that means is, so she's lying on my tummy and I'm obviously lying flat, as I said, so bed, couch, floor, wherever. And I'm finding that there's no fountaining happening when I'm completely flat. Sometimes she's still choking a bit at that letdown reflex, so it's coming quickly but just not as quickly. So if that's happening or I hear her tongue clicking, then I take her off. But it has been better. And the block feeding part of it is, rather than looking at awake periods for how long to feed or how many times to feed on each side, I'm doing it by the clock. So block feeding is generally, usually it can be anywhere from a 3 to 6 hour period where you only feed on off the one breast. So you're still, like, if they're telling you that they're hungry, you're not denying them. You're just putting them back on the emptier breast or the breast that's been fed on multiple times. And the theory there, or the mechanism there, is that the breast that is not being used stays fuller for longer, and that sends a feedback loop, or that's part of a food feedback loop, that then your body doesn't make as much milk in that breast because the message is I'm not getting used up, so don't make this much again. So yeah, it's actually a strategy to reduce my supply, which will reduce the fierceness of the letdown to a degree, and also mean that when she's sucking for longer on the same breast, she can pull out some of the fattier milk that is a bit harder to get at than that initial fast flowing milk that's kind of, you know, very watery. So yeah, it used to sort of be called kind of foremilk and hind milk. It's kind of not really the thing anymore, but that's sort of how the theory of the block feeding works. So I'm hoping that within the next week or so, it should make a difference. I can see that it does make a difference having a longer period of time between feeds overnight. Her poos, if she poos in the night and in the morning, are much more normal than the ones during the day where she's feeding more frequently. And I'm just making sure that I'm kind of having her upright a lot, helping her burp and whatever else she needs to do to get wind out. She hasn't been too distressed by the wind, but she is kind of, she does have a lot of burps to do. And yeah, I think that's because of trying to keep up with this really fast flow. So there you go. That was a lot more about feeding than I anticipated getting into, but that's where we're at. And yeah, thinking back to where I was at this stage with my first baby, and this exact same issue was happening, but I was still sitting up with her, which is the worst position for me. I was feeding the baby for 20 minutes on each side. So when 20 minutes was up, I'd then change her to the other side, which that kind of switch feeding is actually a strategy to increase milk supply. And I had no idea about that. And when I saw the green poos and the mucus and everything else, I started cutting more and more things out of my diet. So I was getting more and more nutrient deficient, I guess. So, and no wonder my anxiety was increasing and we were sleeping less and less because she was more and more uncomfortable. It wasn't a good situation. So I feel like I've got the tools and the support to do it, to do it properly this time and get through fine. She's also had her 6 to 8 week immunizations. When I was there, there were a couple of little spots on her skin that I wanted them to check, and they recommended that I use dactosin cream rather than the usual barrier cream for a while because they could have been little thrush spots. There was only sort of like 3 little pinhead sized marks, but they just would not go away. And within a few days of using that cream, that has cleared up. So we're still in disposables, making sure that that infection is really gone before doing any cloth or anything else like that. So the other thing that I have had checked that I wasn't sure if it was affecting the feeding or not is that she has quite a strong preference of turning her head to one side. She loves the right. She has found her right hand before her left hand as well, so I think it's just a bit more interesting. But she'll, you know, if she had the choice, she'd always fall asleep with her head turned to the right. So when I had my osteopath appointment this week, I took her with me and had them check if there was any flattening of the head, had them check if this was an actual restriction or just a preference, and see if there were any particularly tight muscles. You know, there's a big strong muscle at the front of your neck that connects your jaw to the inside part of your collarbone and then all the way out to the outside part of your collarbone as well. And yeah, I thought that muscle could have been tight and always pulling her over to the right hand side. I was also speculating if perhaps there was a restriction from a cheek tie. So you've probably heard of tongue ties before. When I saw the lactation consultant early on, she said it looked like there was no tongue tie or lip tie at the front, but perhaps a buccal tie. And that's a cheek, like a little membrane between the gum and the cheek. So I just wanted to get that all checked out as well. Seems to be fine. And we're just going to keep doing the things that we have been doing. So when she's awake, always positioning myself over to her left. So she looks at us over to her left-hand side, putting lights and dangly toys and that kind of thing over to the left to encourage her to go to the left. And she did a very gentle release of the neck muscles when we were there, the lightest fingertip pressure. But even within the next 24 hours after that, there was one sleep where she chose to have her head on the left for a while. And that hasn't happened for weeks and weeks. So I'm hoping that she's more comfortable there as well. I wasn't sure if having one side of the face and neck tighter was interfering with her making a really good seal on the breast and having good tongue movement to feed as well. So I'm glad I got that checked out and put my mind at ease there. And she's going to take a look at us again in another 4 or 5 weeks. So that was really good to get that done while I was mostly there, just to get my back and neck looked at. And, you know, left shoulder, being a right-handed person, left shoulder is getting a bit tired from carrying baby around on that side a lot. I have also had a little bit of mother's thumb situation, which is basically like if you imagine the tendonitis and soreness and inflammation that you might get from scrolling your phone too much, that is the kind of thing that you can get just as another unfortunate aside of postpartum. My right thumb has been a bit tender. My left one's been okay. The right one's been worse. And again, I'm not sure if it's just because I'm right-handed and doing more and also using my phone. So that's been a thing to help remind me to not spend as much time on my phone. And also just, you know, like scooping baby up differently and holding the pram differently and the steering wheel if it's feeling a bit tender. If it's a really severe case, you can go to like a physio or an OT and get a splint to keep your thumb still, basically. There's not really too much that you can do because it's hormonally driven. So yeah, I'm just waiting that one out and hoping that one doesn't get any worse. Haven't had any postpartum hives come back, thankfully. And yeah, my body this time doesn't seem to be reacting heaps to my standard foods that are in my diet, but yeah, I don't have many inflammatory foods in there currently anyway. So yeah, things are going all right. I'm really happy to have preschool back on now. So 2 days a week, my big kid's back there. That does mean we spend a lot of hours every week. I reckon I've done 7 hours in the last few days of playing. That it's her first day at kindy and I'm the teacher and I have to welcome her and learn her name and show her where to put her backpack and introduce her to the new children and show her where she eats her food and all, you know, all that kind of stuff that helps them process. But whoa, it's not something that is the most fun thing to be doing, but it is what it is. So yeah, I'm sure I'm making 3 years old sound really, really, really fun. I actually did a survey on my Instagram this week that had around about 200 people respond to it, asking what age people enjoyed most for people who have children who are at least 5 years old, what their favorite age was. And it was split into like 0 to 1, 2 and 3, or 4 and 5. And it was sort of about, I was kind of maybe 40-something percent loved that baby age, 30-something percent loved age 2 and 3 the best, and then 20-something percent loved age 4 and 5 the best. So I love baby stage, but I feel like 4 and 5 is going to be really good for us. Just when there's that slight little bit extra ability to delay gratification, because at the moment there is zero of that. And that is very irritating to me. I'm working through my own stuff about that, but yes. And an understanding of time, because it'll be like 10 o'clock at night. She goes to sleep really, really late at the moment. So it'll be 10 o'clock at night and she'll be saying, "Mom, where are we going today?" I'm like, "Babe, it's 10 at night. Like it's, we're in bed. You're wearing your pajamas. We've brushed your teeth. We're in bed." And she'll say, "But we haven't gone anywhere." And I'll be like, "Well, we just came back from this person's house for dinner and a swim. And before that, you had all day at kindy. So you have been places today." And she'll be like, "Oh, yeah, I forgot." Oh, yes. So it's, yeah, it's a fun time of trying to make the days fun and then having them completely forgotten by dinner time and being whinged at and going, "But where are we going?" I'm sure not every kid and every parent relationship dynamic is like that or like this. And I'm sure it will pass. And I think I'm probably just finding that extra little bit of difficulty when both kids want to be physically on me at all times. Baby's reached a point where she's okay with being with her dad for a while, but it's clear that the preference is me. And same with the older girl. Still the preference is me. So that is can feel a bit suffocating at times. I think I'm talking in circles now, so I'm going to wrap this up. I have been thinking ahead to what my work is going to look like when I come back from mat leave, which will be mid-March. And I've set up my bookings calendar now. So I'll be offering online single sessions and package sessions only, still on a sliding scale pay-as-you-can kind of basis, as I always do for my online staff. I've realized that I really can't keep my sessions to 60 minutes, even if I plan to. So every booking is 90 minutes from now on. And the services that I'll be offering are birth mapping, which is, if you listened to last episode, you probably have an idea of what that is. But basically, instead of a birth plan of I want A, B, C, D, E, F to happen in order, it's really making plan A, plan B, plan C. If you reach this decision point, here's all the information that you need. What would you like to do in this scenario? And having that organized ahead of time rather than in the heat of the moment, so you feel like you have some degree of control over your birth, because yes, birth can be unpredictable, but you can certainly prepare for it. So I'll be offering birth mapping sessions and postpartum planning sessions. I'll also be offering birth debrief sessions and transition to motherhood and postpartum support kind of sessions too. So you can book any of those four services as a single session with me or as a package of 2, 3, or 4 sessions. I will put a link to my booking calendar in the show notes there. So pay as you can, each session anywhere within an 80 to 200 Australian dollar range, and you can book those from anywhere in the world. So I'm opening up about 6 different slots a week from I think the 20th of March is the first day, around about then. So yeah, get in touch with me if you would like that. I've also written a new blog this week about the Trojan horse of the birth world, the epidural, how the gift for the few can be a curse for the many. And when eventually I get around to sending a newsletter, I'll link that. Have a lovely couple of weeks until I speak with you again. I'm going to start recording some interviews again soon. I'm really excited about some of the topics that we'll be covering, which include things like the experience of motherhood when you are neurodivergent, alcohol and motherhood and mummy wine culture, dualing in the dark, and full identity transformation, birth trauma and healing, and I'm sure there are other things as well that I can't remember them all, but I'm excited to bring them to you when the time comes. So check in soon. If you've enjoyed any of the information that I have shared here or previous episodes, remember my audiobook is also free as well. Go way back to season 2. The whole thing's there for you for free. I'd love it if you could leave a 5-star review or a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you use. When this episode's done, just go back there and click 5 stars. If you want to leave a review, you can. These are just ways that we can help other mums find this kind of actual real life content instead of just the Instagram linen shirt version of motherhood. Thank you. I look forward to speaking with you again soon. Bye.